Welcome, Dr. Pilevsky, to Pandora's Box. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
So let's talk about the current controversy about the MMR vaccine. Can you give me your thoughts about the vaccine safety controversy and the evidence for vaccine injury? I know that the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program statistics for February 2015 show that there have been about $3 billion worth of cost for the government and just a little bit less than that in terms of awards for vaccine injury. Your thoughts?
Well, I mean, with the current small outbreak of measles around the country, there are many issues that are being talked about. One is herd immunity. One is contagiousness. Another one is do unvaccinated children actually cause the outbreak? Do they spread it to other children? Many of those subjects are very hard to talk about because the principles upon which many of them are based need to be teased out and re-explored from what we think is true.
I'm sorry, Dr. Pilevsky, just for our listeners who don't know what herd immunity is, can you define herd immunity?
There are two aspects by which herd immunity is used in medicine. One is herd immunity of natural disease and herd immunity through vaccination. Herd immunity of natural disease is based on the concept that when an infection spreads through a community, it is believed that after a certain percentage of the population has experienced the illness, there will be fewer illnesses in those who have yet to have the disease because enough percentage of the population has had the disease and there's less of the germ to spread around. So under those circumstances, a high enough percentage of active illness will make fewer germs available to spread to those who have yet to have the disease. So the uninfected herd is protected by the larger infected herd. And so, again, this is based on the understanding that the disease is spread from an infected person to a non-infected person. So with that as the basis for understanding herd immunity and infectious disease, that concept is then extrapolated to vaccination. And so vaccination is believed to stop the spread of the germ from those who are vaccinated to those who are unvaccinated. So the basic concept there is that the injection of the vaccine actually eliminates the germ from the body of those who've been vaccinated, such that when enough of the population has been vaccinated, there's less germ to be spread to those who have not been vaccinated. Now, we can go into hours of discussion about the intricacies of those definitions and those truths of herd immunity. But for the purposes of a short radio show, I just want to say that there are a lot of inconsistencies and a lot of holes in those definitions of herd immunity that actually make for the possibility that herd immunity is not true. And so we're throwing around a lot of medical terms that have not been teased out properly. Vaccines never eliminate the existence of an organism. They may shift the way in which the organism is expressed, and that may have a domino effect on the introduction of replacement strains that then become potent. But the vaccine never eliminates the existence of an organism. And that's the problem, is that people believe that if you don't see the illness anymore because the vaccine has been used, that the germ must no longer be present.
So, excuse me, Dr. Pilevsky, but what I'm hearing you say, I want to make sure that I understand you, is that for many reasons, and possibly one of them being that we have many people emigrating to the United States from outside of the United States who may be bringing measles with them, and that for other reasons inside the United States, we may never be able to eradicate measles. Now, the CDC said in the year 2000 that they had eradicated measles. Apparently, that was not the case.
Right. And well, again, I've read those studies that people believe that the virus is eradicated. And again, you cannot eradicate an organism. You can change the way in which the organism expresses itself in nature, but you cannot completely make the organism go poof off the earth.
So if you're just listening in, this is Pandora's Box. I'm Lynn Patrick, and I'm talking with Dr. Larry Pilevsky, a board-certified pediatrician in New York. So, Dr. Pilevsky, if we can't eradicate measles, does that mean that the vaccination effort is not going to work, or more importantly, that what we're trying to do by vaccinating everyone is not necessarily going to prevent measles outbreaks we're having now?
Most literature shows that you may be able to change the expression of a certain bacteria or virus by vaccination. But there's always going to be the development of vaccine-induced replacement strains, which means that there's an entire huge family of viruses and bacteria other than the ones that we're vaccinating against. And if you put pressure on changing the expression of any number of those bacteria and viruses, it's going to have a ripple effect to influence the activity and the replication ability of other bacteria and viruses, similar to the way in which we create superbugs because of the overuse of antibiotics. So you can't eliminate the existence of the organism. By using vaccination, you're only going to be chasing your tail, because you're going to have a surgence and an emergence of new strains that may never have been virulent before. And who knows what the infectious profile would be of these new organisms. So you're always going to be chasing your tail when you vaccinate, because nature has a way of adapting. And if you look at the literature on pertussis, you'll see that the new emergence of pertussis illnesses may be a totally different strain of pertussis than the one that we vaccinate against. And now we're having an emergence of parapertussis, which is not the bacteria that we vaccinate against and wasn't really a problem before, but now has emerged as the next strain that's causing the infection. So we're always going to be chasing our tails. And so vaccination may work in the short run, because you squelch or you quiet the expression of the organism, but you can never, ever eliminate it. And you have families of organisms that will change in its dynamic and potentially grow and cause more virulent infections.
Well, if you're just listening in, this is Lynn Patrick on Pandora's Box, and we're interviewing Dr. Larry Pilevsky, board-certified pediatrician from New York City. And we're going to take a short break, but we will be right back, and we're going to talk about some of the concerns with the MMR vaccine. So stay tuned. So welcome back to Pandora's Box. I'm here with board-certified pediatrician Dr. Larry Pilevsky from New York City, and we're talking about the measles outbreak and the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine. So Dr. Pilevsky, because there is a kind of a surgence of parents choosing not to vaccinate, and we're now in a kind of the politics of this, where our president and governors and senators are commenting on whether we should vaccinate or not. What is behind the growing surgence of parents who are choosing not to vaccinate their kids, and what are some of the concerns about the MMR vaccine?
Okay, so much of this started because of the retraction of an Andrew Wakefield study in 1998 in the Lancet Journal, wondering whether there was an association between the MMR and autism. And so it created a flurry of real anger and upset, because the idea is that no one wants to give kids autism, and certainly no one wants to stop the vaccination program. And there was a concern that this study would then make parents not want to give their kids the MMR. And the reason for the MMR is to prevent against measles, mumps, and rubella infections. So once his study was retracted, it was then established that, you see, the MMR has nothing to do with autism. And then more and more what we're told our studies have been labeled as not showing an association between the MMR and autism. 1 in 50 children in the United States has autism diagnosis, and 1 in 6 children in the United States has some form of neurodevelopmental disorder. That indicates that there is something wrong with their brains. And what I mean by wrong is something has impaired the normal sequencing of brain development, and they've developed speech delays, vision problems, motor problems, balance disorders, sensory processing issues, social aspects are impaired. They can't pick up cues. Many of the children are unable to sit still. They have violent outbursts. They're in pain all the time. So there's a general clinical assessment that these kids are highly inflamed. And so more and more parents have reported over the years that they've seen their kid get the MMR, and after getting the MMR, within days, weeks, or even months, their children either regressed or didn't progress in their development. And every time a parent would say this happened after the MMR, the physician would say that's a coincidence. And then the mass media has picked it up and said these are all coincidences. These children are not deteriorating after the MMR, it has nothing to do with the MMR, and something else must be wrong. And the parents keep asking questions, then what? But they're getting no answers. But the bottom line is, people are punching their hands against the wall. They're breaking their hands. They're saying, wait a second, punching the wall broke my hand. And people are being told that the breaking of their hand had nothing to do with punching the wall.
So if you're just joining in, this is Pandora's Box. I'm Lynn Patrick, and I'm here with Dr. Larry Pilevsky, board-certified pediatrician, and we're talking about the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine. So, Dr. Pilevsky, it seems like there may be a connection. What could the potential ingredients or process of the MMR vaccine have to do with neurodevelopmental injury?
Okay, so we have a lot of physicians and parents and government officials and even naturopaths or chiropractors or people who are self-proclaimed experts who say unequivocally that the science is irrefutable, that the MMR does not lead to any brain impairment. But I wonder if people have actually read the package insert of the MMR and studied the ingredients. And so let me step back and give a little science background. The blood-brain barrier is a very intricate network of endothelial cells that protects the brain from most of the contents that flow in the bloodstream. And there are very specific channels of permission in the blood-brain barrier that allow certain chemicals to get in. But certainly, most viruses and bacteria are not allowed through the blood-brain barrier. There are proteins that are not allowed in, albumin, and even blood cells are not allowed into the brain from the across the blood-brain barrier. And there are multiple environmental factors that can disrupt the blood-brain barrier. Microwaves, radiation, infection, inflammation, immaturity, because babies are not born with a full blood-brain barrier, but it does develop pretty well in the first 3 to 6 months. But one of the things that's also able to disintegrate and disrupt the blood-brain barrier is high concentrates of chemicals in the blood. So if you put very high sodium, very high chloride, very high sugar into the blood, you can disrupt the blood-brain barrier, you can make it shrink, and you can open the blood-brain barrier up to contents that are in the bloodstream.
And this will damage the actual brain cells?
Well, the thing is that most chemicals in the bloodstream are not permitted in the brain because they can potentially impair brain function. And so when the brain sees material from the bloodstream that is not meant to be in the brain, there's often a microglial cell activation, which is basically the immune system in the brain that goes to the area where the material has entered and fights it off. And that creates an inflammatory process. And there are some studies in several day-old mice that show when there's inflammation in the brain at certain critical stages of brain development, the brain stops developing and puts its effort towards taking care of the inflammation. And in those mice where brain inflammation happens at very crucial stages of development, those mice are then found later on to have motor problems and behavioral problems. So the question is, are kids' blood-brain barriers being interrupted at crucial stages of their development? And certainly the problem with the MMR potentially is that it contains 14.5 milligrams of sucrose and 14.5 milligrams of sorbitol and 1.9 milligrams of sucrose. And so there are oncologists who use the concentrated sugar mannitol to shrink the blood-brain barrier, open it up to passage of blood contents, who then inject patients with brain cancer with chemotherapeutic agents so it can get into the brain. Because again, clinicians and scientists know that the blood-brain barrier is a very hard barrier to break. Mannitol is a good concentrated sugar that will shrink the blood-brain barrier and allow for passage of the subsequent injection of the chemotherapeutic agent. Sorbitol and mannitol are identical sugars. And so the question really remains is the combination of sorbitol and sucrose in the MMR creating a high enough blood sugar concentration that it opens up the blood-brain barrier to either passage of blood contents into the brain or passage of the live attenuated measles, mumps, and rubella viruses into the brain. And none of these studies have been done, but yet we know that at crucial stages of development, any level of inflammation could stop or detour proper brain development because of the inflammation, and then that might lead to neurodevelopmental issues later on. And so no one's answering the question, no one's asking the question, and that's a huge concern of mine, because sorbitol and sugar can potentially create what's called a hyperosmolar concentration in the blood that leads to the opening of the blood-brain barrier and potential entrance of vaccine materials and bloodstream materials. Now, just to go one step further in that, sorbitol is not licensed by the U.S. government for injection. There are no safety data regarding the injection of sorbitol into the body. We don't know what adverse events can be recorded because they've never been recorded. And sorbitol is also known to be used, like mannitol, to transmit chemotherapeutic agents into the brain. And lastly, sorbitol is also known to disrupt mitochondria, deplete cells of glutathione, and cause apoptosis or cellular death.
And so, Dr. Pilevsky, I just want to let people who are just listening and know that they're listening to you talk about the measles vaccine and the controversy around the measles vaccine. And I'm wondering if you could also comment on the aluminum and mercury that apparently there is still mercury in pediatric vaccines at very low levels, and how those agents might affect neurodevelopmental function.
Well, aluminum is in almost every one of the pediatric vaccines. The MMR does not contain it. The varicella does not contain it. The flu vaccine does not contain aluminum, but almost all the other ones do. And as well as the Gardasil for teenagers. And the thing is that aluminum has been shown in animal studies to cause changes in the brain with cellular death when it's been injected into the body. And you know, I hear experts, at least they call themselves experts, who, you know, stand proudly and say, well, the amount of aluminum that children are injected with is so minor compared to all the toxins that they're exposed to in their lives that it's no big deal. And the real issue is they don't know what they're talking about because they don't differentiate the science between the injection of aluminum and the effects it might have on the body versus the inhalation or the ingestion of aluminum, which may have a totally different pharmacokinetics on the body and absorption rate.
Now, haven't safety studies been done using injected aluminum in animals for the actual approval of the MMR or other vaccines that contain aluminum?
All I know is that aluminum is a neurotoxin. It's been cited as a potential neurodevelopmental toxin. And there's no safety in injecting aluminum into the body. Studies in the animals have shown apoptosis of motor neurons.
And can you explain that for our listeners, what apoptosis means?
Well, apoptosis is cellular death. The aluminum has been found to kill certain neurons in the brain when it's been injected into mice. And the question is that happening in children when they're given vaccines which contain aluminum? But it's a little worse than that, Dr. Patrick, because almost every single pediatric vaccine contains a chemical called polysorbate 80. And polysorbate 80 is known by the pharmaceutical industry as an emulsifier that can be used to bind to pharmaceutical agents to enhance the delivery of pharmaceutical agents across the blood-brain barrier. Again, the pharmaceutical industry understands that it's very hard to get drugs through the blood-brain barrier into the brain if a person has a disease or a condition that needs medication to get into the brain. Polysorbate 80 is used as an emulsifier because it's so lipophilic. It loves fat and can bind to these drugs and enhance delivery of the drugs into the brain. The problem is that aluminum very tightly binds to polysorbate 80. Mercury very tightly binds to polysorbate 80. And vaccine materials like viruses and bacterial antigens very tightly bind to aluminum. So you basically have not only a pathway of entry of aluminum, mercury, and vaccine materials like bacteria and viral antigens attached to polysorbate 80 in almost every single one of the vaccines. That's what children are getting before they get the MMR, which then can open their blood-brain barrier up even further and allow for the entry of measles, mumps, rubella virus, and blood contents. The thing is that polysorbate 80 is also known to impair mitochondrial function. So you have two vaccine agents, sorbitol and polysorbate 80, both of which can pass the blood-brain barrier, or at least open up the blood-brain barrier, both of which destroy mitochondria. And here you have 1 in 6 children with neurodevelopmental disabilities. You have 1 in 50 children with autism, and you have thousands upon thousands of parents complaining that their children were fine and then developed a regression or a lack of progression after the MMR. And so one has to look at this science and say, we know the chemical properties of the ingredients of the MMR and the adverse effects they could have on the blood-brain barrier in the brain. We know how the MMR ingredients can damage mitochondria, deplete cells of glutathione, and cause cell death. We know how polysorbate 80 can do the same thing. With this information in mind, how much of a correlation is there between what we know the MMR ingredients and vaccine ingredients with polysorbate 80 can do to the brain and cellular health, and the development of 1 in 6 children with neurological brain impairment of some kind? And so are you convinced that the MMR is safe hearing this information?
So we may have already spoken about this earlier, but are there any safety studies that have been done comparing a community of non-vaccinated children to a community of vaccinated or a group of vaccinated children in terms of the incidence of these neurodevelopmental delays or damages that we see?
No studies have been done by the pharmaceutical companies, by the vaccine industry, by the FDA, or by any of the medical organizations. So what's interesting is that 1 in 6 children is known to have neurodevelopmental disorders. I wonder what the incidence rate of neurodevelopmental disorders would be if you compared vaccinated to unvaccinated children. And that's never been done.
So there are communities, I'm thinking specifically of the Mennonite community or the Amish community, that for religious reasons don't vaccinate their kids. Have there been any studies of this community of kids in terms of the incidence of autism or the incidence of other neurodevelopmental problems?
Well, there have been no studies. There have been reports that there's much lower incidence of autism and neurodevelopmental disabilities in those populations. But whenever those reports are mentioned, people are very quick to say, well, but they eat differently, they live differently, they don't drive cars, they don't use cell phones, they grow organic, they rarely use antibiotics. So right away, there's a quick knee-jerk response to dissipate any possibility that vaccination could be a real issue.
So given all of the concerns about the MMR and the current political situation, which is that there's some legislation possibly pending in California that will eliminate the exemption possibility for personal exemption for vaccination, how do you counsel your parents of your kids about if they choose not to vaccinate? How do you counsel them about that?
Well, currently, parents still have a choice. In 50 states, there's a medical exemption, although doctors are much more hesitant to write these medical exemptions. 48 states have a religious exemption, and each state defines what a religious exemption is. And then about 19 states have a philosophical exemption, which means that parents can have a conscientious objection to the injection of these materials into their children's bodies. But there is a mass concerted effort around the country to remove these choices and to not allow parents to have these choices anymore. There's a dogmatic belief that the science is irrefutable and that you don't have personal beliefs or religious beliefs about science, and therefore personal beliefs or religious beliefs cannot be taken into consideration when talking about science because the science is irrefutable. And the problem is that if people want to blame me for bringing this information up, they should actually blame my medical school training and residency training, because it was my medical school and residency training that taught me to think critically and to actually look at as many sides of the coin as possible. And this story is not over. The parents are noticing their kids deteriorating. They're noticing their kids have much more health problems after vaccination. And the more they bring it up, the more the authorities are strong-arming them to keep quiet and get their vaccines. There's a pediatrician who wrote something on one of my blogs saying that parents should just shut up and get their kids vaccinated. And parents are just pretty fed up at that paternalistic, arrogant perspective.
I have also seen that there was a study that actually came out of the University of Washington and Seattle Children's Hospital. The conclusion of the study was that when physicians actually talk to their parents and enter into a conversation with them about vaccination, 83% of the time the parents choose not to vaccinate. So the conclusion of the study was that physicians and care providers should not enter into conversations with parents about vaccination. They should literally just say it's time to vaccinate, because they found that when the conversation was not collaborative, vaccination was more likely to happen. So yes, that's happening in actual peer-reviewed published studies, those opinions.
You see, Dr. Patrick, the information that's starting to come out that's easily available that parents are learning about is that the proper safety studies on the MMR and vaccines in general have not been done. And in fact, there's a greater growing evidence in the scientific literature that vaccination may even pose a greater risk to the short and long-term health of the body than the actual diseases themselves.
And so, Dr. Pilevsky, how would you answer your critics' assertion that if we don't vaccinate, we'll have rampant measles outbreaks like they've had in South Africa with thousands of brain-damaged children as a result of the encephalitis from acute measles?
Okay, so first of all, the conditions in which the measles infection occur will determine the degree to which a person or a population will develop poor outcomes from the disease. So the literature is very clear that the more poverty, malnutrition, war, poor sanitation, poor sewage, poor living conditions, poor water supply, lack of clean water supply, the poorer the outcomes are when infectious illnesses occur. The better the living conditions are, the fewer poor outcomes that there are. So in a nourished and healthy population, encephalitis after measles is 1 in 1,000. That's 0.1%. The measles infection in and of itself is almost always a benign illness, just like a cold. It's just not comfortable. There are ways to support the body through a measles infection. There are ways of proper nutrition, dark lighting, decreased stimulation, good hydration, staying with the child. There are herbs, there's homeopathy, there's vitamin A, there's vitamin C. There's good close contact, you should not feed a kid who's sick any food, just lots of fluids. And so there's well documented that it's not a destined poor outcome if you get the measles. And in fact, it's quite the opposite, that more than 99% of the time, you will not have a poor outcome.
So, Dr. Pilevsky, for your parents who make the choice not to vaccinate or would like to make that choice, what are good resources that you send them to online that will help educate them or give them more information, both about their rights, their legal rights, and about the vaccinations themselves?
Well, every vaccine has a package insert, and every parent can obtain the list of vaccine ingredients, and every parent can read about each one of those chemicals, and then every parent can search as to whether or not there are studies that show the safety in children who've been injected with those materials. For parents who are interested in their rights, there is a pro-information, pro-informed choice organization called the National Vaccine Information Center that has an advocacy group, NVICAdvocacy.org, that gives up-to-date information in each state as to what is happening with legislation in each state. The CDC has very lengthy descriptions of what the diseases look like, how they transmit, and what the course of the illness is most often like. And most parents who are interested in having their children remain unvaccinated and whose children come down with one or more of these vaccine-preventable diseases, so they say, there are a host of practitioners who know how to support the body through these illnesses. There are naturopathic physicians. There are herbalists. There are acupuncturists who practice Chinese medicine. There are homeopaths. There are nutritionists. There are chiropractors. There are osteopaths. And more often than not, families are finding great support and great relief for their children. Now, these are not mainstream choices. And some people will say, well, that's medicine going back in the dark ages. Well, actually, it's not medicine going back in the dark ages. It's actually medicine of the future, because if Western medicine can't take care of the illness, it doesn't necessarily mean that it can't be taken care of. And most physicians will say, well, the best way to take care of measles is to just get vaccinated. And again, if 1 in 1,000 cases of encephalitis from a measles infection is less frequent than what the MMR ingredients and other vaccines before the MMR are doing to the blood-brain barrier, then 1 in 50 or even 1 in 6 may be more of a problem than 1 in 1,000.
So just, Dr. Plavsky, to finish up here, what would you like to see happen in the best of all worlds in terms of scientific research to actually determine whether the MMR and other vaccines are safe?
Well, I believe in the precautionary principle. And that says that if there's enough evidence that links a potential greater damage, then we should not be doing what we're doing. And we should actually be fair and study it. And the problem is that people are so convinced that vaccination is the best way to save your life and prevent disease and the least likely to cause harm. And that's not a position that is very easy to negotiate with. And this is a problem. And in the best of worlds, parents would hear this information and they would wake up and say, we're not buying this product anymore. And that's how the economy changes in this country. If people stop buying a product enough, then something has to change.
Well, Dr. Plavsky, I want to thank you very much for being willing to spend so much time with us here on Pandora's Box. We are going to have to wrap up. This has been another segment of Pandora's Box. This has been Lynn Patrick, my co-producer, Tom Yoder, interviewing Dr. Larry Plavsky, a board-certified pediatrician in New York. Thank you very much, Larry.
Thank you, Dr. Patrick.
And this is Pandora's Box, signing off till next time.